Hello, Radioland. You are listening to 91.7 WHUS Stores. This is another episode of Dar Shiv. I'm your host, Graham Stinnett. And today we're playing a previously recorded interview conducted at the Stamford UConn campus with alumni Rodney Bass in December of 2023. We had a conversation about the 1974 Black student sit-in at the Wilbur Cross Library on the Stores campus. We are commemorating the 50th anniversary of that event in the spring of 2024. There will be an exhibition. There will be some programming. And Rodney's story is very important in telling that history. And we're trying to recreate more or less what that experience was through this interview. And I think Rodney, being as generous as he was with his time, is basically the perfect candidate to help us understand a little bit more about the struggles of the African-American student community and their demands upon this university. I hope you enjoy the interview, and please stay tuned. I'm speaking today with Rodney Bass, UConn alum from the class of 1975 when he received his bachelor's degree and then a subsequent master's degree in 1976. He was involved in the organization of African-American students during his time at UConn. I'll ask you to kind of elaborate a little bit about what, you know, the organization itself was or other things you were affiliated with at UConn. But just by way of introduction, we will be sort of memorializing, at least, the 50th anniversary of the Black student sit-in at Wilbur Cross Library, which happened on April 22nd and 23rd of 1974, when you were a year before graduating, where a contingent of students, somewhere around 300, Black students, students of color, occupied the Wilbur Cross Library with a set of demands for then-President Glenn Ferguson to more or less come and deal with some of the demands that the student body was making, ranging from affirmative action plans, changes in intellectual freedoms from the anthropology department, as some saw the research being sort of a racialized way of thinking through that discipline, lack of library materials representing the voices of Black scholars, third world scholars, and also a recognition of the Black arts that were going on campus. And I think you can speak to that pretty specifically, but this is the early to mid 1970s. You know, we're coming out of the 1960s, tumultuous time, the war in Vietnam is still going on. And I'm just kind of wanting to have a chat with you because I know you are one of the best situated people to have this conversation being there. And I first want to thank you for coming on, but just could you tell me a little bit about yourself, your time at UConn contextually, maybe kind of set the stage for us in terms of thinking about what 1974 Stores UConn campus was like for you.
Well, thank you, first of all, for allowing me to come on. I came to UConn the fall of 1971 out of high school here in Stamford. And I came into an environment where here in Stamford, we were pretty, well, I think more heterogeneously mixed than I would say from many of my colleagues that I met from Bridgeport and New Haven and Hartford, where they probably were more homogenized within their communities and certainly their schools. I'm coming from a school that was fairly well mixed, and certainly a community that had rich diversity. So I wasn't as pro-Black and hating everybody else kind of thing coming in from Stamford. Came up to UConn and, you know, quickly learned the lay of the land and determined that, you know, first of all, it was a big deal for Black and brown students to be on this campus because there wasn't much Black and brown diversity anywhere. And so it kind of gravitated and pulled a lot of people together. So we quickly, several students from the UConn summer program, which I was a part of, quickly huddled together for our own sanity and sake, and got involved with the African American Culture Center, which Dr. Fred Simon basically had spearheaded, and he became kind of like our father away from home. So that was our beginning there. And from there, learning the university, and it gave at least me my appearance that the first year or two, the university did a whole bunch to kind of get rid of you. And if you kind of survived to your junior year, it appeared that the university then could turn around for those that weren't shooken off the tree, that you know, they would, there would be resources to enable to help you to get across that finish line, which was graduation.
Right. And remind me, you were receiving an academic scholarship, is that correct?
Correct, yeah. I got an academic scholarship. I came to UConn to play ball. I saw some of my teammates who were on strict athletic scholarships, and so there were certain requirements that they needed to maintain, and as well as trying to break into a lineup that was fairly competitive at that time. I, on the other hand, was on an academic scholarship, so I didn't have the threats, you know, that sometimes went along with being on an athletic scholarship, and just trying to work my way into the lineup and get on the floor as much as I possibly could.
And so it sounded, too, like you had a bit of time, or at least energy, to commit to some of the more organizational things going on campus. Can you tell me a little bit about maybe some of the arts programs that you were involved in, the organization of African American students? What kind of organizations were these? Who came to them? What was the community like?
And that, I think, was a blessing for me, because I was able to stretch out and become acquainted with the OAAS, which was the Organization of African American Students, as well as the Black Voices of Freedom, which was the choir that was developed by Lorraine Williams and Claudette Copeland, Claudette Anderson at the time. That gave rise for a couple of things. First of all, to kind of retain some of the church that we left when we grew up and came in, and that was a way to still enact in a certain amount of worship, as well as singing songs of freedom. There were a lot of cute girls in the choir too, but and thirdly, I think many times when we had opportunities to go to churches to sing on the weekend, it was a way to get something to eat, because, you know, the cafeterias were closed, and students at that time were kind of on their own to, you know, partake in whatever way you could get a meal. And then the OAAS was really about cultural awareness and the importance of staying together, especially Black and Latino students. You know, we kind of, you know, had a pretty close bond at that time at UConn, and out of necessity, someone to talk to, someone to hang out with, someone to have a dance with, you know, because we had a small little house that we call the Black House, and it was, you know, as I remember, a couple of three or four rooms downstairs and then maybe a couple of rooms upstairs. And that represented our meeting place to talk about whatever issues were going on, or play a game of bidwists or whatever. And then, of course, the 300 or 400 students that are on campus, that's the house that we had. And Friday nights and Saturday nights, you know, it was packed because of dancing on the porch, in the hallway, in the bathroom, because there was no other place to go.
Since we're on the topic of sort of logistics and houses, so as you mentioned, the Afro-American Cultural Center had been established previous to your arrival on campus. One of the demands that the students kind of made on the president at that time, during the sit-in and before that, was the kind of general dilapidated nature, or at least just like an unfit space where the official sort of recognition of cultural center happenings maybe wasn't being catered to appropriately. Can you tell me a little bit about that building and it? And its...
Well, that's exactly the same place that we're talking about.
Okay.
You know, we're talking about that dilapidated little house that everything was coming out of, and somewhat of a real, you know, slap in the face to all of the students that were there for the same higher learning that everyone else was learning to. So, yeah, it was, you know, and I think we had a couple of meetings there to demonstrate those conditions. You know, when you invite the black students on campus and then reporters come in and they see everybody hanging out of the windows and everything else, and they're saying, is there someplace else that we could go? And we're saying, that's the point.
Right.
You know, this is not appropriate setting for representing. If you care about students of color on this campus, this is inappropriate.
Right. So was this building on campus proper? Was
yes. Yes. It was on right down from Eddie Hall. As I remember, I don't know what the name of the street was, but right down on the left-hand side, it was a small brown house. I think you would think it would be maybe a one or two bedroom house with an upstairs, a porch, and two or three rooms downstairs.
So the OAAS, would they have their meetings in that
yes.
building?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I also noticed, just going through some of the records that we have at the Archives and Special Collections, ranging from student activism files to the president's papers, which documents a lot of the administrative perspective of what's going on from the ground. There's mention of the Puerto Rican House being a place. Do you recall that as
yes.
being a site
mm-hmm.
to hang
right.
out?
Right. And actually, I would say because of our close association with the Latino students on campus, they had a Quonset hut type of place right off of the Student Union building, which was larger, and at least it would be able to house the parties that we wanted to have. So many times, you know, rather than cramming into this sardine-cased little house that we had, we would have the parties over there, you know. And again, because of, I think, the fraternization between black and Latino students, it kind of worked that, you know, it was less of an inconvenience and cramped kind of place, sure.
Right. So I want to kind of walk through a little bit about the events basically that take place in mid-April till the end of April. We have these very striking photographs of students, including yourself, some being carried out by state police from the Wilbur Cross Library, others being escorted out. And really, we don't have a lot of the perspective of students themselves in those files. These photographs were largely surveillance photographs taken more or less to kind of identify who are these students and who can maybe we hold responsible and put on academic probation or something
sure.
like this for having broken the rules of the library. Our records more or less tell that tale. We also have some flyers. I've brought in a few to kind of sort of talk out with you a little bit, but I would love to really get sort of the contextual account, as you recall, as being one of the organizing students. You know, your name is on a lot of these documents.
Yeah.
You had, I'll just kind of start from that point, on April 11th, a silent march to Gully Hall by 300 black students, in which yourself, Rodney Bass, and another student presented a letter to President Ferguson stating that the Afro-American Cultural Center was inadequate, there was a lack of support for black arts programs, there was a laxity in the affirmative action plan, the Board of Trustee extension of the Biocultural Anthropology Department, which has its own sort of story to tell in this moment. You delivered that statement. It's also attached to 13 demands on behalf of the black students at UConn to the president, and you then requested a response by the president no later than April the 16th, so that's about a week's worth of time. Do you recall kind of the planning that went into getting folks to kind of come together to organize 300 students to march silently to Gully Hall to deliver this, you know, I'm sure what was planned, written document?
Yeah, well, I do remember, and I don't want to take the responsibility for all of that. We had some grad students that were on the campus that brought some of the concerns that they were having to our attention. And because I think the OAAS was a recognized organization on campus, and many of the grad students had no such organization, they brought some of their concerns, and actually as older students were able to help us negotiate how we should approach. So the first one was to get your attention, demonstrate that this was something that we were interested in and we wanted a response before we ratcheted up a little bit and then became more direct in our concern, which is why there was a silent thing. There was a letter writing campaign that the president basically opened his briefcase and took every single one of them and many times apologized as he was taking them because he seemed to be a sincere individual. I think, although overwhelmed, that, you know, he was not keenly aware that this was as an important concern as possible. You have to remember that before the 70s, there were very, very few black students, and this UConn summer program basically was, I think, an attempt to really bring more minority students to the university and to the campus. And so therefore, it appeared necessary, at least from our perspective, that the university embrace that, as opposed to continuing to think that there's maybe one or two black or Latino students moving around this large facility and there was nothing needed to change in terms of moving forward in persons' pursuit of their education.
So the change of demographics, also the demands upon a state institution, hopefully needing to reflect a little bit more of the population.
Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. And just you mentioning the letter writing campaign, I find this extremely fascinating. Within the Ferguson files, we have basically a stack of those letters. And you and I were kind of discussing a photograph that appears in an issue of Contact, which was the newsletter put out by the Afro-American Cultural Center in 1974, the month of May. And it is a photograph of Ferguson receiving these letters, putting them in his briefcase. Yeah. Each letter, though, is a pre-typed letter. It kind of states the same things. We have these demands. We would like you to meet us on this level to be able to at least have the discussion to get us closer to meeting these demands. And then specifically the letters which state, "Your response is what black students have come to realize as the standard administrative procedure for dealing with the concerns and issues that affect us. Vague and ambiguous procrastination. Your middle-of-the-road response will serve as impetus to intensify our protests in the coming days and months. Please personally respond." Signed, Rodney Bass. Signed, numbers of individuals. So we have a stack, and what's great is it's a form letter. You know, it's been pre-sort of discussed, written out, printed. But then each of you wrote in your own kind of hand, you know, your signature, but then also, "I would like to be responded to personally. Right. Please speak to me when responding to this letter," sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Kind of like making the machine face the individual and recognize that this is a group concern.
Absolutely.
And I find that to be a very fascinating technique in which you're making your voices heard.
Right.
So that's very cool. That occurred on April 17th. The day before that, so the Ferguson administration responds to those initial 13 demands on April the 16th, where he suggests that the introduction anyway to the letter is like, "Well, I received this letter on the day that I was coming back from a civil rights organization meeting in Boston, so I wasn't able to respond the next day, which was a holiday, then it was a weekend, and then it was a Monday that classes were canceled or something, so I wasn't able to get to this until Tuesday, so that left me with one day to respond to these demands, and all of these demands require a task force, an administrator, a pile of money to set towards these issues," doing exactly what you guys sort of said in the next line, which is you're doing what the administrative procedure is with dealing with these kinds of issues, put us off. But more or less, you know, he kind of says, like, I would like to think these things through, but as far as a student who was at a university for 4 years, you know, tomorrow is kind of here and gone. There's not a lot of time to really meet these demands,
right,
in the time frame of a student who is typically thinking about graduating. So April 17th letter writing campaign happens the day after. There is then sort of a non-response. And correct me if I'm wrong, the next sort of thing that occurs is you guys occupying the library on April the 22nd. Do you remember anything in between?
I think what happened is that the media was getting a hold of some things. I do distinctly remember the inner team that was doing a lot of the planning and everything, was very concerned that we weren't infiltrated and basically taken off a direction that was not in step with what we actually wanted. I do remember there were a couple of people that it never was disproven, but we thought were like detectives or something that were masked as students that were part of us, and they were walking in and they didn't have the letter and they were in the line, and some of our, you know, athletes who were there walked up to them and said, "Who are you?" You know, because we all knew each other. And what are you doing here? "Well, you know, I'm a student from another school," and we asked them to leave, you know, to protect the direction and the integrity of what we were trying to do. So I think between those couple of days, there was more strategy about what was going on. And I would also add that some of the information's like the issue with the anthropology department, Ginsburg, looking at the research that would determine that African Americans are genetically inferior to other people. And one of the students that happened to be a grad student, young lady, brought to our attention these kinds of concerns based on the fact that those two were being funded at the same rate as the other eight people in the department, kind of sent a message that, well, maybe the university feels that, you know, this research is as important as any other research, and of course to the detriment of how Black and Latino students may be viewed on campus. So, you know, the undergrad piece of this gets hold of that, of course, and gets excited. So we needed to kind of think very quickly about what next steps we could do that weren't going to necessarily endanger, but make a more specific statement, since we perceive that the things that we have done up to this point were falling on deaf ears.
Right. I mean, I love hearing this sort of role of graduate students are at this other level of their academic careers. Undergraduates clearly are at a different level. They're kind of there for the experience almost of university, plus then getting the degree.
Right.
It's all part of that learning process. So there's some solidarity happening across academic lines. One of the demands also was to reassess or at least reinstitute a adjunct faculty member or someone who is on the lower rung or recent sort of hire in the anthropology department for being dismissed, possibly unfairly. So there's also some tenuous labor relationship
sure.
issues being brought up there. It felt like you guys had a very sort of coalesced wing of solidarity thinking when you were putting this whole organization
together. As best
together.
We could. And again, Dr. Fred Simon, Dr. Adams, there were a few other faculty members that we trusted, Carolyn McDew. We trusted these people to as adults in this situation. So we, of course, wanted to move forward and got some advice, but certainly wanted to make sure that we weren't getting them in any kind of, you know, employee trouble, because, you know, they were the only ones that we had. Eileen Backus, you know, there were a number of faculty members that understood our plight, and basically, even though they could not directly steer the ship themselves, but were sympathetic to what we were doing. And, you know, of course, there were a number of some of our students who understood what was happening in their own communities with the Black Panthers and stuff like that. And even though the Black Panthers at that time were doing some incredible work within communities of educating children and feeding programs and other things, you know, most of white America were concerned with the violence and the "I'm not taking it anymore" kind of thing. So you had some students on campus that wanted to ratchet it up. And I think that, of course, the grad students, as well as those people that I just mentioned, helped to temper what we were going to do to get attention, but not go too far off as possibly little immature and excited students could tend to do. So that, you know, something would occur,
right.
A message would be given.
Right. What was the general feeling that you had about the rest of the campus? How in tune was sort of the average student you'd be sitting next to in an English class? How were they considering your guys' movement at that time?
I can't even remember some of who else outside the realm of the people that were directly involved in this issue. I didn't even know any of them. I remember having my psychology 132 class in Vondermeiden, and there were 1,500 students there. You know, I was told when I left Stanford, make sure that you personalize yourself with some of your I went up to the professor and introduced myself, and he said, I don't care who you are, you know, your grade will be by your social security number on the board, you know. And so that was like, so yes, we didn't really have any direct touch with other students, and that included members of the basketball team. Many of them, even though we played together and were somewhat cohesive in terms of playing, I remember just before the state police came in, some of our scholarship players ducking out the back door. They had to, you know, because their scholarships were at stake here, you know. And D. Rowe, love him to death, God rest him soul. But, you know, D, he told me many years later, at the time that this was going on, he didn't understand. And it was many years later that he basically admitted that, you know, we did something that he at that time did not understand, but was very necessary for the growth of the university.
Right. For those not aware, D. Rowe, beloved basketball coach.
Absolutely, yeah.
UConn men's. The impact of the season of basketball that year. So this is taking place April. Were you guys still playing, or was the season over by that point?
I think, if memory serves me, I know that our junior year and our senior year, we did have postseason play. We played in the NIT, which was the first time UConn had, for about 20 years, had been able to actually make it to postseason play. I'm not sure whether, because we won the first round, and we were playing in the second round against Boston College. So I'm not quite sure whether that was finished or not. If we weren't playing, we just finished,
right,
you know, at the end of the year.
Do you remember thinking through how it would affect your, not just scholarship, you know, access to continue being a basketball player, but like, do you believe that maybe some of the athletes were under threat of being benched, or performance-wise, maybe it affecting them if they were to be involved?
I really believe that Mustafa Abdul Salam, at that time, his name was Earl Wilson. He was our captain of the basketball team, and he was very involved in the OAAS, an outright spokesman for many of the things that we were doing. I don't recall whether or not he was pushed out because of our concern for him not losing, you know, any particular position. But certainly many of the basketball team members were right there until the very end. And yes, they had to, as far as I was concerned, not be a part and blamed for any of the progression of things that we were doing. For me, again, because I was on an academic scholarship, I didn't think about it too much until afterwards, when I was called in and told that I was a troublemaker, and that my continued existence on the campus could be compromised, and that I had a lot of problems with the system. And I remember my response was, doesn't a lot of people have a lot of problems with the system mm-hmm. that it's currently going on? And if it wasn't, I don't think, for Dr. A.J. Papanico, who was the director of the special ed department, that may have been it for me in terms of UConn. But for whatever reasons, he said that he liked my moxie and he gave me a chance. I think he spoke up for me, and I was absolutely allowed to continue, and then ultimately got into his postgraduate program, which led to my master's.
Right. That's heartening to hear that there are mentors along the way, however few, but those who are sort of,
right,
you know, looking out for students that they know can succeed given the right opportunity.
Sure.
Yeah. So Monday, April 22nd, as the record states, roughly 250 students of color arrive at Wilbur Cross Library. For those who are currently on the store's campus, the Homer Babbage Library was not built at that time, which is the current library. It was at the Wilbur Cross building. They have two very large reading rooms that have been restored now to what I imagine was their original look, but without the books and periodicals and things now, you have a harder time imagining it. But those students stage a sit-in protest before midnight in the Northwest Reading Room in order to have President Ferguson meet the demands that were issued to him. So the library closes at midnight. You guys have entered. You have kind of intentionally sat together in a space of the library. Can you tell me a little bit about the feeling of we're about to do something here, you don't know what's going to happen? How did that feel?
That was exactly it. We were together. We did not know how that would be addressed. We were concerned. I remember Dr. Claudette Anderson Copeland, who is a minister out in San Antonio with a very large ministry. She was there with me, and she wrote me a note. And she was kind of our director in the choir as well, so, and one of the spiritual leaders on the campus. And she wrote, you know, almost a spiritual response, fear not, God's with us, and this kind of thing, and encouragement. Because after reading the statement, the security person came and said, once again, it is 12 o'clock and the university library is closing, blah, 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 this, that, and the other. And I read the statement again. And then to some applause from our people, and we then sat back down quietly. And that's when the concerns started, like, what's going to happen? We didn't know. We had no idea until morning when the state police showed up.
You had read a statement. Do you mind reading that for us?
Faced with inadequate facilities, the black students of the University of Connecticut have come to occupy this library, not only to get more definitive and specific responses to our demands, but also to dramatize our urgent need for a cultural center wherein we may study together and come together as a group unified in our ethnicity. We will study here until 6 a.m., at which time we are hopeful that President Ferguson, Vice President Ken Wilson, and Dean John Manning will come here and address themselves to our demands. If these administrators do not come, we are committed to stay here and not leave until they do.
Thank you. So at about 5 a.m., Ferguson meets with the Commissioner of the State Police, whereby at 6 a.m., the state police begin evicting and then subsequently charging 219 of you with criminal trespass, in which they utilize shuttle buses that apparently were the school's buses that then stopped shuttle service to get to classes for students who were not involved in this. So there was an additional logistical disruption. Folks were shipped off to the Mansfield Training School or the police barracks in Stafford Springs.
Correct.
To be booked. In addition to the disruption with the buses, there was a closure of the library that day because apparently somewhat of a mess was made in the disarray of the arrests. Some had sort of suggested that it was the students themselves who had made a large mess. All of the records that we have from the Cultural Center documentation basically says this was the police coming in and physically lifting us out of our spots and moving things and creating this sort of hubbub. So I also have that validated by the interview that I did with Library Director Norman Stevens, who was overseeing the library at that time. He was called in the middle of the night when you guys sat in at the library, and he said the students were completely well-behaved. There was no disruption whatsoever. And by all accounts, it was the actual physical removal by the state police that led to any of this disruption. So yeah, just to kind of unpack a little bit about that moment, you know, I guess, how were you kind of feeling at that time when all of a sudden you see now police enter the building?
Well, you know, first of all, what are they going to do? Second of all, some people have had experiences, others have not, with the police. So how now do we continue to control the responses from the students? And some officers went in and grabbed people right away, and they began to push back and flail. And I remember many times we constantly were yelling out, don't stop, don't fight back, don't fight back, because we didn't want anybody to get hurt. And we certainly didn't want to create what we thought would be escalation, because we've seen this in the 60s. We've seen what happens when, you know, you fight back with the police and then, of course, they escalate. So we certainly had tried to speak to people that were coming into the library that night in preparation. Listen, you know, we need to maintain our self-control and not be, you know, get out of control and let things go wrong for us. I remember when they grabbed me, because I was kind of big, you know, they said many people were getting rug burns because they were dragging them across the rugs. And they started pulling me, and I basically said, I'll get up. And I basically was walked out of the thing, rather than some others who refused to get up, and then they were pulled, and that created some of the angst that we're talking about.
Right. Yeah. So you were put on a bus.
Yeah.
And do you recall if you were taken to the Stafford Springs barracks?
Yeah, I went to the barracks, right.
Okay.
And I was one of the last ones. In fact, I was with another brother, and he was one of the coolest brothers I've ever seen. He always walked around with an umbrella. And we were the last two on the bus. And this heavy set, red face, very tired and aggravated officer said, okay, you two guys. And I remember him leaning forward and saying, isn't this the bus to Hartford? And the guy was like, his expression was, not today, not today. And so they took us back into the barracks. He went first and he said, what's your name? And he responded, Martin Luther King III. And I filled out all the information. And he said, okay, sign here. And he signed his actual name. And the officer said, excuse me, but your name, Martin, is different than... And so then he crumpled it up and threw it away. He said, let's start all over again. He says, what's your name? And he replied, Martin Luther King III. I'll get it right this time. You know, so even in the midst of being tired, being scared, you know, there were some brevity and, you know, some real uplift from some of our people that were there. But yeah, we were processed down there and, as you said, charged with criminal trespass and didn't really know what that meant, because many of us were soon to go home. It was May and we were going to go home and maybe get a letter from the university, don't come back, or whatever. Until I think some other students went into the library and a smaller demonstration took place. But some of those people were grandsons and granddaughters of some very prominent people in the state of Connecticut. And I think that then the state was kind of put in a position of, now what do we do? If we deal with these people differently than we deal with this one, it's going to cause more of a problem. And lo and behold, many of the charges were nollied, as far as I understood. Yeah.
Right. So that following sit-in that you referenced happened, I believe, early Wednesday morning, the 24th of April. About 70 predominantly white students mm-hmm. and faculty member also occupied a section of the library. They were similarly identified, told this is closing time, you know, if you remain here. And then at about 5:30, police began to evict those same students as well. So a repeat of 2 days basically before that. So this organization, this group, we have student newspapers from a group called the Coalition, and we have some documentation similarly to sort of flyers about meetings and rallies and things that they had produced that talked a lot about the same kind of like solidarity issues that you were describing, that the Latino students and yourselves saw as overlap. You know, the women's movement is a big part of this, of course.
Sure.
Do you recall any kind of overlap with that same kind of organization?
I don't really remember much of an overlap. I do remember similar kinds of concerns that we were having, and it was kind of an aha moment. Oh, you know, see, you know, that kind of thing. Much of a validation of some of the things that we were concerned with. I don't really recall whether we joined forces with anyone. I do remember one of the major concerns that was brought to the university that no one answered is that somebody that wanted to do research in black studies had to go to Hartford to get any information from the library. And, you know, that was one of the reasons that we chose to go in the library, to prove that very point. This place doesn't offer anything for anyone who is trying to look introspectively at where they came from or what who they are. And don't you see a problem with that? And so I do remember that there was some parallel concerns that organizations have, and maybe we were the ones who kind of were some of the tipping point that got people starting to look more critically at what was going on, rather than having this sleepy, just as you said before, middle of the road, less than genuous responses to some of these things. It didn't go away.
So the library is an intentional part of this sit-in, the direct action that you all decided to take. It had importance. What happened to the organization after that? Did you guys stay in touch? Did you have meetings after the arrests? Did the Organization of African American Students hold meetings after that to discuss how to deal with this?
So, yes, we had some meetings afterwards. Some of the leaders, the underlying leaders of this particular movement, of course, graduated and moved on, the grad students, so there weren't necessarily the same cast of grad students to kind of advise us as we came back. Basically, we then, I think, looked to, again, Carolyn McDew and Dr. Simons and others. Now that we've gotten some attention, how should we best channel this information? And one of the things that I think started right away was the movement of the cultural center from that Black house down to the area of the student union. So that basically happened pretty quickly afterwards. And then, of course, now what do we insert there? What kinds of programs should be looked at and be a part of that organization so that there is growth and movement toward furthering the education, the offerings, the, you know, things that would entice other Black and brown students to come to university. So I think basically the beginnings of those things were pretty much the discussion that we had going forward in my time that was at UConn. Personally, I became the director of the choir. We actually were becoming pretty well known throughout the East Coast, and we had done some work with Nikki Giovanni in the Virgin Islands and other things. So I was devoting between basketball, my studies, and the choir. I was, you know, doing more work there. You know, other people were picking up the ball with the cultural, political kinds of things that were going on.
And the choir group itself, Black Voices of Freedom, arts organizations involved were Black media, heritage, jazz movers. And then within that, sort of the Black community's organizing is Big Brothers, the Black Athletic Association and Recruitment Program, also Contact, the newsletter coming out of the African American Cultural Center at that time. You know, there are several organizing bodies happening here. Yeah. You seem to be a part of just about half of them,
well,
if not
yeah,
more.
I was, you know, and of course, when we went out on a performance, for example, Jazz Movers, they were with us, so that our halftime piece was giving them an opportunity, an audience to be on the stage. I did Dr. Adams. Fred Adams was in charge of Big Brothers and Big Sisters, and I did an independent study for him with the Big Brothers program. You know, the athletic piece, come on, guys, let's go down and do a benefit for. So again, not to say, oh, I was just eager to have many hats. It just was because there was so few of us and we were so tightly connected with one another. We often just complemented and worked as best we could in all of these environments to try to promote culture, you know, dance, singing, arts, and other things. And many of the people that were in the choir were also the people in Contact, were also in the Jazz Movers, were also part of the arts and other kinds of areas. And it was just who stepped up to represent that particular organization at a particular time, which again speaks to the intimacy that we had as students on the campus.
It makes me kind of wonder, or what sort of like additional labor do you feel like was required of you all, being some of the first actual numbers of Black students on campus? How much did you have to give extra in order to sort of make the presence of African American students on the store's campus known. Obviously, the direct action that you all were involved in led to the creation, at least, of a functioning African-American cultural center, still there today, very central piece of the African-American experience on our campus today. You guys had to do this almost to kind of make that happen. Who knows how much longer it would have taken for the administration to decide that this was something they needed to do without pressure. How much more were you expected to give in order to make that place a community? Well, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think I do. But you have to remember, most of us came out of understanding what the civil rights of the 60s were about. You know, 68, Dr. King was assassinated. 65, Malcolm X was assassinated. The Panthers had been engaged. So there were many opportunities of our past to be educated about what it takes to go forward. I don't know that any of us were in the mindset of, oh, this is too much, you know, that kind of thing. I think we were in the mindset of, if we don't do it, it's not going to get done. And we're doing our best to do what we have. And I kind of think that that comes out of the experience, the Black experience, through civil rights and back as far as you can look at, even now, as highlighted in the 1619 Project from Anna Nicole Jones. You know, you see that people have weathered mountains with practically nothing because it was necessary to do. And I kind of think that mantra has always been with a lot of students who, we used to call it dues paying, in terms of your parents always told you that you need to be twice as good to be equal with. And basically, I think that attitude about get it done as best as we can was certainly something that held us together as students on the campus. And therefore, you could look to somebody else for that support, and then they would arm you and say, yeah, we'll try and we'll do it. And that's pretty much the mindset I think we had in those particular tumultuous times.
Right. Mm-hmm. Kind of got you through almost.
Yeah.
In a eye towards closing the conversation, I'm wondering what sort of advice you would have for students today on a campus regarding the role of activism, organizing, you know, many of these issues from the list of 13 were not met. What would you suggest students take away from your experience?
Well, what I think is important, and I'm kind of happy to hear that there is a remembrance, a 50-year remembrance of what had happened in that place. You know, there's a lot of morphing that goes on, meaning that things are moving and morph, but they don't really change. And I think many times we get lulled to sleep with thinking that change is actually occurring when there's just covering and paying attention to something else, which oftentimes allows what had been clearly established to be ignored. And so therefore, certainly I'm glad that the 74 sit-in is not being ignored, and that students that are there have an opportunity to look at that and preserve and even move forward in terms of what students back then thought were important, so that they don't go away. You see many things that are happening in our society today, where we're actually fighting to hold on to things that at once were clearly established as laws and things, and now they're up for grabs. And so certainly I would hope that students would value their education and pay attention to some of the things that have happened, so that we, first of all, don't lose them, and that we were able to move forward as opposed to having to fight the same fights over again 50 years later.
Very well said. My hope too, of course, with doing this interview as well as an exhibition that hopefully shows students the look and feel of this 1974 period. I mean, you even mentioning kind of like the state of the campus itself, and that you needed a house to do this and have that kind of space to do the organizing work, is a very different kind of place that students are in now.
Yeah.
Do you still suggest kids go to college?
Actually, I do. I have had the good fortune. In 1994, I had the opportunity to go to West Africa. And I went with my church. And I went to Senegal, and specifically to Gori Island, which is 2 miles off of the city of Dakar. And there, Uncle Joe, as he was called, was giving us a clearer understanding of why the African slave trade had taken off, and the many of the truths about it. And I stood there for 30, 40 minutes, a man that at that time was an administrator. I was an assistant principal at the time in Stanford Public Schools. I had 3 degrees, a master's, a BA, and a 6th year, and had been engaged in a doctoral program for human management resources for 2 years with a residency. And I was ABD. I didn't finish the dissertation. And I'm learning stuff that I never knew. And I'm saying, wow, if I don't know this, how many other people don't actually understand really what the Atlantic slave trade was really all about? So it was so profound on me that I returned to the States, and I worked for maybe 8-10 years trying to seek funding, and finally got some outside funding and developed a program that we call the Rites of Passage Program. And we started educating middle school students about these very facts that they were not learning or understood within the general curriculum that was being taught in Stanford Public Schools. And for 10 years, we actually provided 15, 16 weeks of instruction on Saturdays to a group of students. And it culminated with a 10-day trip to West Africa to show them and provide for them the actual information that we thought would strengthen their desire to be more personally aware and concerned with their personal education. If that intent to be able to ask the why question, to be able to utilize and not just meander and move forward without understanding where we're going and why. And that was important. The good news is I did that right up into 2014. I retired from being principal at Stanford High School in 2009, 2010. And this year, in fact, last Saturday, we received, with the help of some very young people in an organization that is called DOPE, Do Not Oppress, Educate. We are starting, and we inducted 18 students to another round of the Rites of Passage program, where we'll be teaching 15 weeks of instruction to high school students and taking them 10 days to Ghana in June, which again is furthering why do kids go to college? They should go to college with some understanding of what college should do for them as opposed to what they can do for college. They should go and seek out and make sure that they're getting out of the university what they need, as opposed to going through and trying to satisfy courses and other things that may not help them to do eventually what they want to do. So it's these kinds of programs and this type of education that I feel is fundamentally important, especially for Black and brown students. And as they go forward, it appears, at least from the data that we've collected, that it works. One of our students that I had in the 8th grade, her name is Kishana Sojour. She is Dr. Sojour. She is the first African-American woman to get a PhD in the history department at Syracuse. And, you know, we have a number of those that we believe, not to take full credit, but as a tipping point, it really started to become meaningful what education can do for us, as opposed to what, you know, we passed through that portal and maybe didn't glean all the things that we needed. So yes, I think college is important, as long as college is providing you with the experience and other kinds of things that are necessary for you to take the next step.
Right. Very encouraging words. That's probably a softball question for you, being a lifelong learner and educator. So yes, that is very exciting to hear about the way that you've kind of connected education as being one of these tools that largely will inform the democratic process, really. Yes. Like, make us more engaged in the society in which we're
absolutely
coming out at the end with these credentials. So very encouraging to hear, Rodney. Any last thoughts regarding the topic?
Just, you know, a shout out to Dr. Sharon White. Was Sharon Johnson. She went to school with me in the summer program. She was the former president of the UConn branch here. Another testimony to perseverance and uplift, and certainly one that when we were talking about when I was principal and she was still here, we were actually toying with the idea of having UConn students mentor the high school students and trying to provide them with a college credit for doing so. As with the Voices of Freedom now on the college campus, one of the efforts that Lorraine had worked on was actually to provide a college credit. And I know before I left UConn, that had been that actually occurred. So your participation in the Black Voices of Freedom back then actually gave you a college credit, which again was an advancement and awareness of, yes, university is aware and is actually connecting and allowing these organizations to actually be represented as a real part of the umbrella of university. So, you know, we were working on that, and our superintendent, Dr. Temu Lucera in Stanford, has actually given a high school credit for participation in the Rites of Passage program now. So again, all of that to say, when you put some meaning behind it, money and or credit, it becomes more legitimate. And we think that those things that we tried to do 50 years ago, wow, 50 years, I can't believe it, 50 years ago was to add credit and legitimacy to what we were actually looking at and hopefully holding on to as a preservation for our future.
Right. This has been great, Rodney. Thank you so much. Again, Mr. Rodney Bass, class of 1975, and then a master's in 1976 from UConn Stores, chairman of the Organization of the African American Students, and one of the student representatives during this 1974 Black Student Sit-In at the Wilbercross Library. We're commemorating the 50th anniversary of that event this spring, and I just want to thank you again, Rodney, for coming to speak with me about this topic.
My pleasure, Grandma. Thank you for having me.
I'm your host, Graham Stinnett. You've been listening to another episode of Darshiv on 91.7 WHUS Stores. For more information on the Archives and Special Collections, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and the web. Our theme song is Dream in Cassio Tone by Arable Lands. Graphic design by Melika Stinnett. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.